You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
And now here's Rod Adams and Shane Brown with The Atomic Show.
It's atomic. It's atomic.
Okay. Well, I haven't really had very much. I mean, I've looked through the Google search that you suggested, and I see just the usual glut. So I don't really have any favorites to play.
I realized that when I sent you that email, I forgot to mention I was using Google News rather than just Google search.
Right.
So I was looking at news articles, and there's quite a few just in today that are worth a little mention, a little discussion.
Okay. So well, the nice started. Thing about Google is I can just say, click the news link, and it does exactly the same search on that section of the site, so I'm immediately there.
Yeah, one of the interesting ones I wanted to start with was the one from the independent student newspaper of the University of Tennessee. If you'll, it's a Daily Beacon Online, and it's called Nuclear Power on the Rise.
Okay.
And I'll give you a couple minutes to take a look at that while I'm trying to make sure I got my ducks in a row, and then probably go from there. There's also an interesting one called Greenhouse Gases versus Plutonium.
I saw the email that you sent the guy inviting him for an interview.
So, yeah. And
so I take it he comes out on the plutonium side of the equation as being the higher threat?
Well, he's a geologist and, of course, has been studying Yucca Mountain for many years, you know, lifetime employment kind of thing.
Right.
As you probably know, you've obviously got a smattering of geology. The vast majority of employed geologists in the world work for one industry.
The deep geological disposal industry?
No.
Oh, wait a second. Sorry, I'm not thinking.
What are you thinking?
Petroleum. The petroleum industry?
Well, petroleum meaning including natural gas and coal. Because
right, right. So in the industry of previously living but now very, very dead, many millions of years dead geological formations that used to be alive?
Correct. Correct. I mean, the vast majority of you know, geology employment, and it's a very well-paying profession, by the way, has to do with, you know, looking for things under the crust of the earth, things of value, of course.
Right.
So I can't.
So I found the Daily Beacon article.
Okay.
And
good. Take a look through that, and particularly take a look at how she describes the alternatives to nuclear. It's kind of interesting. I think it's a she. Let's see. Ashley, yeah, I would say that's a she.
Yep.
All right, and while you're reading that, I'm going to introduce us because we're going to kind of merge and play with this and see what we can make it sound like.
Okay.
Okay, this is The Atomic Show, and I'm Rod Adams coming to you from Annapolis, Maryland.
And I'm Shane Brown coming to you from Los Lunas, New Mexico. Pardon my distracted state as I finish off this article.
Okay. And see, while Shane is reading, I will tell you that this is Atomic Show number 34. We've been doing this for quite a while. And just a little brief introduction in case you've never listened to the show before. This show is all about atomic energy. And we try to talk about everything we can think of with regard to atomic energy, from the economics to the politics to the history, some technology, and sometimes we just really get into some geeky conversations because both Shane and I are enthusiastic about the technology and its opportunities, but we recognize that not everybody in the world agrees with us. So if you are a person who's concerned or interested and wants to talk about atomic energy but maybe have a different viewpoint, we'd love to have you on the show. So just get in contact. My email address is rod_adams@atomicinsights.com. And you can also find me at the atomic.thepodcastnetwork.com and leave a comment on the blog. And probably by now, Shane, who's a quick reader, will have finished the article we wanted to discuss, or at least the first article we wanted to discuss.
So this is an article from the Daily Beacon, which is a student newspaper at University of Tennessee, and it's called Nuclear Power on the Rise. And she starts off in the, I believe it's a she, the name of the author is Ashley Yeager, so if it actually turns out that that person is male, my apologies. It starts off a little bit what I thought would be alarmist, and then it turned into a very even tempered article, basically stating that, talking about Watts Bar, which happens to be a nuclear power plant in the Tennessee Valley Authority system in Tennessee, which is a fairly large employer in Tennessee. And apparently there was a director of the university's nuclear engineering program spoke at a university physics colloquium a couple of weeks ago and talked about the different kinds of power plants that utilities in the United States are considering and why nuclear power plants can be considered green power plants, and then goes into a, at least to my mind, a pretty straightforward analysis. Splitting uranium does not require oxygen and does not produce carbon dioxide. Point taken, point clear.
Yeah, one of the things I, there's some couple phrases in here that just were fun to find in a college newspaper. Things like, in fact, nuclear power has the lowest cost generation. Price per kilowatt hour has been steady since 2000, when it became the cheapest form of electricity generation, as compared to coal, oil, and gas, of course, because the other sources were not steady. They continued to go up.
Right. I also like the term that she uses, when the nuclear power plants fire up. That's an interesting turn of phrase to use.
Yeah.
Now, she also puts, goes to, the Watts Bar was the last of the U.S. nuclear power plants to, quote-unquote, go critical. Critical is just not a good word. I mean, it's a perfectly good word when you're a nuclear geek in the 40s. And you think of things in terms of what they mathematically and physically mean first and what they inspire in the minds of people who are not up on the technology second or dead last, in fact. I think when they say critical, they should really say balanced.
Yeah, because what critical means is that the rate of producing neutrons and the rate of losing neutrons is equal. So the power stays steady. And we always, if we're trying to get power out of a reactor, want it to be critical.
Kind of like a seesaw that is very difficult, but it is possible to balance it perfectly balanced. And it can, and imagine that the seesaw controls a switch that allows pretty much unlimited amounts of power to pass through, but only when the seesaw is perfectly level.
But, you know, the funny thing is that it's not hard to make a nuclear reactor stay in balance. They have a wonderful characteristic in that if you design them properly, and there's no secret as to how to do that, the reactor, once you move its control elements to a certain location, the reactor will pretty much do everything it has to do to maintain its temperature constant. And that doesn't require the motion of any control elements and doesn't require any feedback mechanisms that are unnatural, that are, you know, electronic or anything like that. The reactor simply wants to keep its temperature constant. If it starts to cool down because somebody tries to remove some of the heat, the reaction speeds up a little bit till it gets back to the temperature. If it somebody stops removing the heat and makes the reactor start to heat up, the reactor slows down. It's an amazing device.
So control rods are used more for safety shutdown, and also there are safety rods, so that's a separate system. So they're used to compensate for burn-up? Or?
Well, the control rods have several features, several things that they do in a reactor. They do compensate for burn-up, so if you move them to a certain position, the reactor is critical. After a period of time, you have to move them a little bit further up, because you are using up some of the fuel very slowly, of course, because uranium is very energy dense, and it only takes about a kilogram of fuel a day to fuel a reactor large enough to power a city of 1 million people. But the control rods are also used to establish the temperature at which the reactor is critical. Because the reactor can be critical at a very low temperature. And as you raise the rods up, it raises the temperature at which the reactor is critical. The final thing is for safety shutdown. When you start the reactor up, you have the rods at a certain position. And most of the time, rods are designed to fall into the core if there's a loss of power.
Or be pneumatically pushed up into the core in the case of a boiling water reactor. But
oh, correct.
I didn't mean to imply that criticality is hard to achieve. I mean, criticality was achievable 60-some-odd years ago by a bunch of guys underneath a squash court in Chicago with a very large pile of rather pure graphite, which is just basically carbon. I mean, it's very purified form of the kind of stuff that you put in your backyard barbecue. And they were able to bring a reactor up to about, I believe the power level that they got to was just about a quarter of a watt thermal, mm-hmm. and that was from a space about 10, about maybe 20 or 30 feet on the side, a cube-shaped structure. And that was high enough for them to be able to definitively show that they could control the reactor, but not so high as to require shielding.
Right.
And that was the CP1.
Well, the other neat thing about that was that the people who were doing that experiment knew the physics well enough from the experiments that they had done to be able to predict within just a few centimeters of exactly how far they would have to move the rods to allow for criticality. And they made it the first time. There was no having to tear down the facility and build it up again or anything like that. It was simply a very easy, once you understood the reactions, physical predictions. And the other neat thing about this phenomenon of fission was, once it was demonstrated, there were tens of demonstrations of the same phenomenon all around the world. There was no secrets. There was no secret sauce. There was an amazing amount of ability to simply do it all over again. Kind of in contrast to something like cold fusion or whatever other weird anomalies that people find these days.
The various and sundry free energy and energy amplifying mechanisms that you find all kinds of conversations going on about. I believe there was a story maybe a couple few weeks ago from a company in Ireland. I believe the name of the company was Storm. And they had made a claim that they had a machine that could produce more energy than it consumed, and it used some very interesting geometry in order to achieve these, again, very strange shaped motions. But fundamentally, unless you have an extraordinarily convincing case, I mean, a case that any scientist of any walk of life or persuasion can walk up to, like they could with fission 60 years ago, and do whatever they needed to do to convince themselves that it worked. Not just, okay, it's only going to work on Tuesdays and Thursdays when the guys who designed the device are there. No.
That's the funny thing about real science, is real science is repeatable, it's observable, it's something that you can, once you've figured it out, you can explain it to almost anyone who has the slightest bit of scientific education. Anyway, going back to this article, here's another phrase that I thought was kind of amusing and leads me to believe that the author might actually be a nuclear engineering major. But it says, despite the large waters of power production, nuclear power generation accounts for 20% of the nation's electricity, leaving environmentally hazardous power generation methods such as coal and natural gas, along with renewable sources such as wind power, to generate the other 80%. I love it.
Interesting lumping there. It's renewable resources getting lumped in the same phrase as coal and natural gas. And really, when you think about it, wind and solar, as we've covered before, they are not altogether chirping birds and sunshine, as their proponents would have you believe. I mean, there is a problem that most wind turbines in California have had since they brought the first ones online in the 70s, is that they actually cause bird kills of endangered species. There are bird species that happen to have their migratory paths go right through the area where they have all these wind turbines on top of the same ridges where these soaring birds like condors happen to fly, because they're really consistent breezes there where they can spot their prey on the ground. So they try to occupy the same space. And unfortunately, a blade 5 meters long is going to win a contest every time with a condor, no matter how endangered it is.
Yep. And of course, the blades are getting longer and longer these days. I think that some of the most recent windmills that have been, or wind turbines that have been produced, have blades where the blade radius is on the order of 33 meters. Actually not longer than that. I'm sorry, that they're in excess of 70 meters long for the longest blades these days.
So that means that the radius of the disc of the windmill is on order of the size of a football stadium.
Yep. It sure
That's
is.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, it's they're amazingly large and quite ugly machines. But here's another article that I thought was kind of interesting, and it comes from a website that's called Plenty. It's subtitled, "It's Easy Being Green." And, of course, apparently this guy doesn't have the clue yet that blue is a new green, but not everybody's read my blog articles yet.
We'll get to that later.
We'll get to that later. But here's this one starts off interesting. More and more environmentalists are coming around to the idea of nuclear power. It's technologically viable, obviously, since we have 443 reactors operating around the world. It's safer than ever, and best of all, its contribution to our greenhouse gas output is virtually nil, say its proponents. But there's the other side. A professor of geological sciences, and according to this, nuclear engineering, isn't convinced that the benefits of nuclear power outweigh the drawbacks. That's Rodney Ewing. And Rodney Ewing, according to his CV, curriculum vit, what is that last word? Curriculum something or other?
Vitae.
Vitae, that's it. Curriculum vitae, Latin stuff, meaning your resume. Of course, the people in the academic world like to use some, Latin phrases. But Rodney Ewing is not an nuclear engineer. He is a geologist who has been spending a lot of time over the last dozen or so years studying the geology at Yucca Mountain. And he doesn't think it's safe enough to store waste in, or at least we don't know enough yet. However, I've got some beef with Professor Ewing's, at least his market research capabilities, because he claims, according to this article, that we have 400 nuclear power plants in the U.S., which is...
Where's the other 300?
Which is obviously the world total, not the U.S. total.
Right.
And he believes that we would need to build 1,200 plants by the year 2050 to increase the amount of nuclear power plants by a factor of 3, which is, again, obviously false. In the U.S., if you built simply 300 new nuclear plants, you'd be producing about 80% of the country's electricity with nuclear power, allowing us to completely shut down the coal industry.
Because not all plants are the same size, and plants come in a variety of sizes. I mean, they come in everything from gas-powered peakers, which are down in the neighborhood of 50 to 100 megawatts or less, all the way up to facilities like the Grand Coulee Dam, which put out over 3 to 4 to 5 gigawatts of electrical power. Mm-hmm. And present design nuclear plants that are cooled with light water tend toward the high end, although the sizes are coming down a little bit, as we've talked about in previous shows.
Yeah, they tend, right now, there's three designs. Let's see, there's two that are actually approved, have NRC licenses, and that's the ABWR and the AP1000. And both of those, actually three, because there's the AP600. And the ABWR and the AP1000 are roughly 1,100, 1,200 megawatt plants. And then the next one that's being designed is the EPR, US EPR, and that's about 1,600 megawatts. So basic, like I said, since 103 power plants supply 20% of our electricity, even though some of them are smaller than 1,000 megawatts, you can easily see that 300 more of them, giving us a total of 400 in the U.S., would be enough for 80% of the power. Simple math.
Yep, that's... It's not hard to follow, but again, you have to, sometimes it's hard to get to know where to get started when you're trying to pick apart things that are in contentious debate, even though technically they shouldn't be. And it's kind of like the point that Dr. Cohen made in Before It's Too Late, which was, it's about a 20-year-old book now. And he said in the book that it was a bit kind of a proto FAQ in the back of the book with common questions. And one of the questions was, but why should we believe scientists when the scientific community is split? And he said, well, there is a split. However, I quibble about where the split occurs. It's not 50-50. It's more like 99-1.
Well, you know, my experience is that there are plenty of people with engineering and science backgrounds and with wonderful educations who have questions about the continued use of nuclear energy. There's economic questions, which are legitimate, particularly if you draw straight lines from previous experience. And there are also simply questions of priority. You know, is it better to do new nuclear development or over something that's quicker and cheaper. However, some of the folks who oppose nuclear energy, who are very technically oriented, do so because they know that it threatens their livelihood. It's a simple fact.
Their livelihoods may not be... So I wonder how they claim their livelihoods when they put in their tax returns every year. Consultant? Any nuclear industry?
Oh,
how exactly do you fill out that 1040?
Oh, it doesn't really matter. You just put in consultant or publisher or something, and you know, that's the nature of the beast. When you're dealing with an industry as large and as competitive as the energy industry, you have to be ready for some opposition, and you have to recognize that something that's really, really good is going to get a lot of pot shots, kind of like a really, really good pitcher gets a lot of pot shots. People who maybe think that he has foreign substances on his hand. I don't know.
Yeah, that was weird.
I saw
that in the morning on the news this morning. That's okay. And then the umpire association getting up and saying, there wasn't anything actually wrong. Sorry we drew your attention to it.
Yeah. All right, so there's another article that says that EDF, that's Electricité de France, has won the approval of the European Commission or European Union to build a new nuclear plant in Flamanville, northern France. The EU or the European Commission has approved the EDF proposed construction of a new nuclear power plant in Flamanville. Northern France.
How is it spelled?
Flamanville. So this reactor will be based on the same design as the reactor that's being built in Finland. And, of course, there will be plenty of people who will point out that the reactor being built in Finland has been experiencing some not very surprising first-of-a-kind issues.
So this is this. I'm looking up the article now. This is a pressurized water reactor, which is similar in design to the one that Areva has gotten through the NRC's process.
The one that Areva is getting through the NRC process, but
okay, I thought it was finished.
I don't think so. I think the EPR is exactly the same design, with the exception that the U.S. EPR is being converted to using more standard measurement systems, etc., here in the U.S., which is not a necessarily simple task when you think about all of the things that have to be measured in a construction site as large as a nuclear reactor.
Right.
But U.S. construction industry and U.S. Manufacturers of pumps and valves and everything else just simply, unfortunately, don't use the metric system very much. So.
And unfortunately, we are in the minority on that. And it's likely that we will remain in the minority for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, it's just
inertia. You know, it's more than, you know, people getting used to a different measuring system. I worked in a factory and operated some complex machinery.
It's the tooling, isn't it?
It's the tooling. I tell you, I mean, when you think about the number of bolts and screws and calipers and injection molding rotors, just incredible number of things that simply wouldn't work because the tolerances just aren't there to say, well, it's kind of sort of a 15 millimeter, but it's not really. It's got to be exact. So.
And here's an interesting industrial thought experiment for those of you who might not be familiar with this problem. Take a look at any hammer, any tool, any set of pliers. Imagine what kind of tool would be used to make that, and then imagine what kind of tool would have been used to make the previous, and think about how many generations of tools there have been between what you can go down and buy at your local home improvement store and a guy with a rock a couple thousand years ago.
Yeah, there's lots of things that have to be changed. And, of course, the U.S. is a big enough market that most everybody else in the world manufactures stuff that does fit in with our standards. So, anyway.
What about the difference in frequency, the AC frequency that's used in France versus the United States, and the fact that they have to use different poles and different number of poles in the generators?
Yeah, absolutely. The difference between 50 hertz and 60 hertz is a huge deal. It's not just a matter of running the turbine at a different speed. You have to, like you said, change the generator design, and you have to do some rebalancing and redesign of the turbine so that you don't have weird harmonics show up. So,
right.
Anyway, it's not a huge redesign, but it's not as easy as one might think. But the one that's going to be built in Flamanville obviously doesn't have that problem. It will be identical to the Finland power plant, but probably experience far less problems, hopefully, because the lessons are being learned every day in Finland. You know, any large, complex project has a learning curve, and it's been a long time since a new nuclear power plant was built, even in Europe. It's been about 20 years.
And all the guys and also women who are involved have gone on and moved on and retired, and there's very few people who are left to teach those lessons before they have to be learned the hard way.
Well, even if they're there, you know, if you haven't done something for 20 years, you probably are a little rusty. I mean, when I think about, okay, I'm not a terribly young guy, but put myself back to what I was doing 20 years ago, I was Oh, I had almost just died taking over the chief engineer position on board a submarine 19 years ago. If I was to have to do exactly the same job today as I did then, I would have a lot of scale and rust to scrape off before I got to those memories.
Can't argue with that.
Yep. That's pretty good news because, you know, getting another plant going in Europe is a good deal. Good thing.
Yep. So, of course, France is also the site of some other interesting things happening in the nuclear industry and also in science. We may save this for another show, but I'll mention in passing that it was finally decided after something like, 20 years of deliberation that a place in southern France, Cadarache, France, was going to be the site for ITER, which it's an ironic name considering what it does to the money that's gone into the project. It stands for the International Thermonuclear Energy Reactor, and it's basically a very large, not science experiment, because they know how to build it such that the plasma conditions can be reached. It's an engineering problem in the sense that we really don't know all that well how to turn a flux of neutrons that are about 15 times stronger in terms of energy than those that come off of a fission reaction into heat without making the reactor's capacity factor absolutely miserable and causing the cost of the plant to become just totally outrageous.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of fusion, as we've talked about before. I guess I'm kind of lazy, and I'm also more interested, I guess, in turning a buck. I'm sorry, I really shouldn't say it that way. I'm interested in in providing power that people can really use and will pay for. And so fusion just doesn't wet my whistle. You know, it's completely and totally dependent upon subsidies, government subsidies, because they don't have a product they can sell.
Right. So I have some differing thoughts on that. They're not too different, but I think we can save that for another time. But
hey, that's, you know, the different opinions make the world go round, so I won't fire you. Just
plus, I deeply enjoy pushing buttons, as listeners of this show know.
That's okay, because, you know, I just, fusion is the energy of the future, and it always will be.
It always has been, and it always will be.
You know, and I guess the other
constant
problem,
time to completion.
The other problem that I really have with fusion is that it provides ammunition to the anti-nukes, because it's the fusion expenditures, which they point to as subsidies for the nuclear industry, although they have nothing to do with production of power in commercial reactors. And I get in debates all the time with people who say, well, nuclear is just too expensive or requires too many subsidies. There are no subsidies for operating reactors. Those guys pay a whole bunch of taxes.
Yeah.
And they have huge decommissioning funds all set aside. Think about how many steel mills and oil wells and all kinds of other nasty industrial facilities have no decommissioning fund, and they're, you know, what's the typical method of decommissioning a factory?
Entropy.
Lock the doors and walk away. You know, and then let the kids in the neighborhood throw rocks and break all the windows.
And then you get a, what is it? It's a broken window syndrome.
Yeah.
It's a study that they did in the inner city somewhere. And they parked a nice car, and they had a videotape running on the car for a while. And then the first day, nothing happened to this car because it didn't have a scratch on it. And then as an experiment, one of the filmmakers threw a rock through the window of the car, and in the next 2 hours, the car was stripped down to the chassis.
Amazing. I think they did a similar, not experiment, but they actually took action in a similar neighborhood. in New York. They had a bunch of project buildings that where the windows had all been broken out and all that stuff, and they ended up going through and putting paintings in what used to be the window, paintings of you know, domestic scenes of with plants in the window and furniture and all kinds of stuff. And the crime rate in the area dropped by a half. Just because it looked
pretty smart. So,
but anyway, so
moving on.
When we decommission a nuclear plant, we take it down to a green field, and the only thing that's left over right now, and it's only because we don't have, you know, a process in place for moving this stuff, is the leftover fuel, and they have to maintain the cooling pool or the dry storage facilities. I think mostly dry storage facilities in the completely decommissioned plants.
And yeah, I don't think they can maintain a spent fuel pond. They let the fuel cool in the cooling pond until it can be taken into dry storage, and then they finish the decommissioning.
Right. I think you're right. And, of course, that fuel, there's no reason why that fuel couldn't be simply moved to the site of an operating reactor that already has a storage facility outside. And I think that's one thing that the new waste policies are investigating. I think there's some bills that are being investigated right now to make that possible.
Yep, there are several Native American reservations in the United States who have expressed a deep and concerted interest in taking possession and taking the rather lucrative fees that would be paid to someone willing to deal with, as babysitting goes, a pretty mellow kid. Okay, what have we really got to do with this thing? We got these concrete cylinders, 20 feet high, 10 feet wide, that are built rather robustly to the point where most things that we can think of to do to them would not bother them. So what does it really require? A guard, a couple radios, maybe a truck, yeah. And we'll check on them once a day. Okay, did they fall over? No. Okay, how much longer do we have to do this indefinitely? Is this really hard? No. It's not a glowing green goop inside that's probing at with gnashing teeth at the inside of the container looking to corrode a way out. I mean, it's a coffee cup that happens to shine at a frequency of light that happens to be penetrating, which is the reason why we have to put it inside of concrete.
Yep. Yeah, it's anyway, it's not hard, and of course, let me see if I can say this in a nice, correct manner. I just don't think the Indian should have all the fun. I think that a private citizen ought to be able to buy a couple hundred acres of land that's not being very, you know, well used. In other words, it'd be pretty cheap. And put a fence around it and say, come put your stuff here. And, you know, pay me the 1 mil per kilowatt hour of the power that was generated from this stuff. I figure that, let's see, for three canisters, I once figured out that the waste fee would be something like, I don't know, $3 or $4 million to put three cans in your backyard. Large cans, granted, large cans. But that's a pretty hefty fee, you know. You
right.
could buy a nice piece of waterfront property, even here in Maryland, for $3 million.
Yeah, or buy a nice piece of mountain property up in Santa Fe, for that matter. I mean, there are some places here that have just gone totally out of sight. But, yeah, I believe the nearest one I've heard of is one in Skull Mountain Reservation in Utah. I think they were the ones who got the farthest along.
Yeah, they actually got a license from the NRC.
They got a license, more power to them. It's just now it's a matter of getting through the next hurdle, which is transporting the material, which isn't a hurdle except in the sense that there are an awful lot of people whose pockets would be enriched rather strongly by keeping the issue in play as long as possible.
Well, I think, and I'm digging in memory, so please, people, don't quote me. Look it up. Do your own research, but I'm pretty sure that the Skull Mountain project right now is being held up by the Department of the Interior which has the title to some of the land necessary to get entrance to the facility. And they're saying that they won't allow the material to pass through. Of course, this is the same U.S. government that whose other arm licensed the facility. And anyway, it's an interesting bit of politics going on there. But you know, there's some other great facilities that would be perfect for storing waste. They already have security set up and all that stuff. You know, like Savannah River, Oak Ridge, something like that would be a great place to build a nice parking lot and park some fuel. I mean, to me, I would put the fuel someplace reasonably close to an industrial capability so that after the fuel's cooled down and it's much easier to handle, then people say, look at all that resource over there that we should probably do something with, like reprocess it, recycle it, put it into new reactors. But
right.
That's another dead horse. Well, it's not a dead horse. It's another horse that I keep beating and hope that it's going to take me across the finish line someday.
We've probably progressed past the red horse into a red spot on the highway, but
no. Like I said, it's not a dead horse. It is a horse that is dashing its way. It just doesn't look it yet. And it's going to get across the finish line someday. I know it. I can feel it in my bones.
All right. So
anyway, there was, let's see, there's some stuff about Duke Power giving their some of their stockholders a little bit of information about some new plants they want to build. There seems to be as much opposition to the coal-fired plants as to the nuclear plants. And, of course, the opposition is, do we really need to build these plants and take the risk of investing our money into these things? And fortunately, the CEO of Duke Power or Duke Energy says, "Yep, we do."
Yeah. If you do any research at all, and you are a dispassionate investor, if for no other reason, look at what Warren Buffett is doing. I mean, the man lives in a house that he paid. I looked this up on Wikipedia, and it was taken from another source, but apparently he's been living in the same house since the 60s when he paid only not a whole lot of money for it, and he's never moved. And the man is possibly the most successful investor to ever walk the earth, and he's excited about it. If he's excited about it, or at least halfway enthusiastic, he's done his market research. The market research has been done, and it looks pretty good.
Well, Warren Buffett,
even with all the limitations.
Yeah. Well, actually, Warren Buffett likes investing in things that have limitations, and of course, there are big hurdles to entry into nuclear power. You have to have an awful lot of ability to study and be patient, and you know, withstand opposition and stuff. And Warren, if you look at some of the things that have been his most successful in investments, he loves to invest in something that is a monopoly or a near monopoly. One of the reasons why he loved newspapers for a long time. But yeah, he's excited. He's also put up $50 million as part of the $50 million pledge to a international fuel fund to provide a fuel bank for developing nations so that they don't get tempted to enrich uranium.
So I've actually heard some chatter about that on the internet this past couple weeks. People have been talking about the non-proliferation benefits of an international fuel bank, and this actually goes back to the Baruch plan after World War II that was floated.
Yep.
And it was just—it's not a new idea. It's a very old idea. It's just been a logistics question and politics questions more than anything else.
Well, one of the reasons that it's never really gone very far is that there's an awful lot of developing nations who have some smart people who take a good look at a gift horse and say, you know, we really do need to take a look at the teeth on this thing and see if it's how old it is and what we're really getting and how much maintenance we're getting and how much cost we're getting imposed upon us. And you know, if these guys really want to give us this stuff, why do they want to give it to us? And, you know, why don't they want us to develop our own industry? You know, there's a lot of questions to be asked. Traditionally, the people that had enrichment capabilities and were suppliers of fuel put some rather strict demands on their customers as to what they could do with the fuel once they got it. And some of the customers didn't like those restrictions. You know, some restrictions like you couldn't recycle it. You had to use it, and as soon as it was, you know, initially used up, no matter how much was really left, you had to turn it back in, and you had to open your facilities for complete inspections on demand, which, of course, is kind of a pain if you're trying to operate an industrial facility, because complete inspection means you have to shut it down. And that's not such a good thing if you're trying to run a power plant.
There are also ways that you could redesign power plants to make frequent inspections easier. And in fact, I believe some of the designs that I've seen have been designed. Well, there's different ways of doing it. There's also the ideas of totally hermetically sealing a reactor at the factory where it was inspected. Mm-hmm. And basically, you barge the reactor, or you move the reactor wherever it's going to be used. It goes through its entire lifetime, and then you bring it back to the factory.
I like that method. I like that method a lot, by the way.
I'm kind of partial to the idea of making reactors that are sufficiently, what was the term? TV commercial now, but it's, basically, if you build something like a bank vault the size of a building, or a bank vault that happens to be semi-portable in the sense that anything that happens to be 50 or 100 or 150 tons can be portable,
mm-hmm.
It's going to be rather resistant to being moved without people noticing the equipment that you're using to move it.
Right. It's sort of like the places where you stop it along the highway and they have a great big basket on the restroom key. It's an encumbering device. You know, it's hard to lose this thing and hard to, you know, move it without somebody noticing.
Exceedingly robust design. I think we're just at the beginning of the S-curve. So.
Absolutely. There's an amazing amount of development ready to be done, and we just got to get started and start getting some revenues coming in so that we can start doing some more. So.
Okay, so I'm done rambling for now.
And I am, too. It's been one of those newsy shows, and I do want to invite anyone who's going to be at the American Nuclear Society Winter Meeting in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Starting the 12th of November through the 17th, I'll be there. I'll be talking on a panel discussion with John Wheeler of This Week in Nuclear and Eric McErlane of the NEI Nuclear Notes, and we're talking about new media and the nuclear use of the new media. For those of you who've been around the nuclear industry an awful long time and have often heard people say, well, the media just doesn't like us, this is a new age. We can be the media, so there's no excuse anymore. Of course, I never really accepted that excuse since Westinghouse and General Electric owned the media, but that's just another story.
All right.
Take care. And go listen to John Wheeler's podcast, This Week in Nuclear. He does a good job. And besides
Absolutely.
That, he likes Adams engines.
All right.
Take care,
Sam. Have a good
week,
Paul.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, I really hate those podcasts that start off with all the loud rock and roll music.
Ooh, I hate screaming commercials.
Especially when you can hear Hawaiian music while you're learning about a Macintosh.
From the island of Maui.
On the Mac Help from Maui podcast.
Listen, you might learn something.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need. Something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. Ooh, there's
there's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.